Hey everybody, welcome to Frontside, the podcast. I'm Charles.
I'm Brandon.
And today we actually have a very special guest.
Extremely special in almost every conceivable way. So we're really, really excited to have Michael Cote, otherwise known as Just Cote, on the podcast with us. And we want to talk about some stuff. But Michael, Mr. Cote, can you introduce the universe of developers, the vast universe of our listeners, to you and your work and what you do?
Sure. Well, so I'm an industry analyst at the moment and for quite some time. And basically what that means is we have clients of various types, and they want some help understanding what's going on in the tech world and what to do there. And they come to us, and we explain it in a way that is helpful, whether that may be in text or running our mouths or helping them with their marketing activities like webinars, something your listeners hopefully are not too beset with, or speaking engagements. You know, we're just an odd sort of thin layer of explaining what's happening in the tech world. And I came about to doing that largely because of one of the podcasts Charles and I used to do. The famous soft poo episode that is often credited as a turning point in my career. That's our old drunkenretired.com podcast that we do about once every 3 years now. So those are special episodes. They're kind of like the Christmas edition of MASH or something. And so I used to be a programmer for about a decade or so. And then I did a lot of podcasts and blogging, and the previous firm I worked at, Redmonk, kind of discovered me through all of that. And they're like, oh, look, this guy knows how to communicate, which is true. When I got my reviews as a programmer, I always ranked five, with five being the best for documentation, which you can imagine, you guys in the audience being programmers, that did not equate to a lot of money. So
no, we got a guy for that.
Yeah. They're like, documentations is for wusses. But if you can communicate effectively and explain complicated things that make sort of business sense, then industry analysis is the thing for you.
And is that the whole monk analogy? I get this like kind of
gathering the red monk thing. Well,
and I'm transcribing it for
the origin story of Red Monk. The name is as with all origin stories, there's what do they say, retconning of like the reason, which that's probably one of them. But really, I think James Governor, one of the founders, the fan of soft poo, he said he was sitting at some conference trying to think of a name for a firm, and he was thinking about Microsoft and IBM, which of course is in Redmond and RMonk, and he just kind of threw those together, and then there was the magic of the domain name being available. So there you go.
That's the domain registers are basically the new USPTO, right? Like you don't check patent trade office anymore because you're more likely to like step on a bad domain than a taken trademark anymore.
Yeah, I think so. That's why companies have kind of if you don't mind, kind of stupid names nowadays, right? That are not very descriptive, but they're just
like the front side
and
for free chicken bucks.
and you know, I can't really blame them. Like I was looking through some survey data that we had about various DevOps tools that people use. And the more stupid the name, the easier it is to look up in Google and verify. So like, you know, it's better than having like if the name of your product was Release Manager, you're kind of screwed, right? So it's good to have funky names.
The best are the ones that have the generic name, but they're like, you know what? That's a lot. That's a mouthful. It's just going to be called like CRC. Mm. We're going to go with CRC.
Right. Yep. Sort of like your BMWs of the world.
Yeah.
Who just like use some, what are those numbers? To like describe their cars.
Yeah. Oh yeah. You got the 10, 12, 14 package. That's a pretty sweet monitoring system.
Yeah. So,
you spend your days writing.
I think that was an introduction.
Yeah. You spend your days mostly researching, I'm assuming.
Right. Writing. So, just to give a little color of what an analyst does, essentially, you have to research, as you say, understand what's going on out there, because most analysts aren't really like practitioners, because that's not what we get paid for. So we don't understand what's happening in the tech world by doing it firsthand all the time, which is a little offensive for some people, but you know, such is life. So we'll get briefings from people. Vendors will talk to us and explain to us in 30 to 60 minute chunks why they're awesome and what their releases are, And then we also do our own research and go to conferences and talk to people. And then we'll spend a fair amount of time outputting, if you will. So we'll write up reports on like, there's a new version of GitHub Enterprise out. Here's what it does. And here's its competitors and like how it fits in. And then another sizable chunk is spent on basically consulting, which is mostly the phone, maybe answering some emails, and every now and then, like, I'm going out to visit a company next week to talk with them for like 6 hours on what DevOps means for them.
So, and what's the difference then between that? And, like, where's the overlap in between that and tech journalism? Because a lot of sure. what you describe sounds like, you know,
right. So,
a journalistic endeavor.
So in general, with exceptions that kind of prove the rule, to use that old stupid phrase, tech journalists don't really inject a lot of opinion or advice into their coverage, right? So part of what makes places like when there's a really good article from like TechCrunch or The Register, part of what makes them interesting and valuable is they do inject bias and their own thinking into it every now and then, if only in tone and selection and things like that.
So more Dear Abby, less Joel.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, this is a gross simplification, but I always say that the analysts are like the editorial section
right.
of the paper,
okay.
right? So a lot of what we do by necessity of covering what we think about an industry, we have to journalistically just report the facts. But then, you know, the most valuable part that an analyst will do is tell you what the context for that is, being like how this came about, what it fits into, how it works. And then more importantly, like, as I like to summarize it, is that a thing? Right, like,
right.
is this something or not? Right,
can
like,
I do something with that?
Like, you know, you could what's an example? You could write an example on let's say that there was a company. What was the name of the old version controlled system? Not CVS, right?
CVS.
Yeah, yeah, very old. You can tell it's been a long time. But you know, let's say there was a company called like you know CVS, and they were in charge of the CVS version control system, and they released version 10, right? A tech journalist would be like, oh, it's got these new features and it's been around here for a while. And it'd be kind of just the facts and you're done. Whereas an analyst, if they were doing a good job, would say like, well, it's got these new features and also no one uses this. It's really old. Right?
don't do it.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's more of having that opinion that like is helpful for whoever your audience may be. And so in general, like there's three types of people who consume analyst information. There's what we would call end users, or sometimes you'll hear it be enterprises. That is non-technical companies who are using IT, right? So they're people who like, remember we had that long discussion a long time ago about what enterprise software is? And like, it's like, so if we were I'm pointing around here. If we were to go that way, there's a bunch of state of Texas buildings. And there's probably IT people there who are in charge of running IT. And they don't program stuff on their own necessarily or do things, but they need advice about like, should I buy VMware? Right, like they want information about what's good for them to
run. They have server racks that are painted beige.
Right, right, right. And their concerns are very different than the concerns of like developers mm-hmm. and like other things like that. And then there's also those people consume industry analyst stuff to basically help them figure out what to buy and not to buy and how to use it. And we get lots of requests like our VMware licenses are coming up and we want to build a private cloud. And I'm making this gesture like, no, right? And it's like, so, help us figure out where to start and what to do. And so, you know, when you get down in the weeds, you really want some consultants who will come in and do that for you. But at the beginning, you want some analysts who will kind of point you to the right direction of stuff.
Okay.
So then there's also vendors who primarily, the two reasons they want to talk with industry analysts. One of them is to get kind of the same information. They want to know what's going on out there and get some advice about what they should be doing. And then two, they always want you to say nice things about them. So that's kind of the marketing side of it. And then three, there's sort of like, I would call it like the finance and strategy community. And these are people, whether they're VCs or banks or private equity people, they only need information in so much as it allows them to figure out what to invest in and what not to invest in. And some of the, another bucket in there are M&A people who are working on mergers and acquisitions, mostly just acquisitions. And similarly, they need to know about companies like, We need to buy this kind of company. There's 10 companies in there. I don't know who those 10 companies are. First, tell me that and then help me rank them as far as what's good or bad. And
right.
Just allocating capital, whether you're doing M&A or investing.
Okay. So yeah. That's a good, because conspicuously missing from that list is developers.
Developers are awesome at reaping their own news, right? Like developers are generally, most of them that I've met, certainly in the open source community, are kind of news hounds. And so every developer I've met, it feels like a micro tech analyst. Most developers I work with, they have a thing of, hey, my job is to stay on top of what's going on in tech. I subscribe to all the newsletters. I know what's getting released. And
I
certainly
the Front Side podcast.
Yeah. And they feel like they're the feeling what they don't realize is they're on, generally developers on some crazy, in the world, they're on this crazy leading edge of stuff.
Right, right.
But they feel like they're falling, constantly in danger of falling behind within their own ecosystem. And so
sure.
There's this, you know, scramble constantly to stay on at the very, like, spear's edge of technology. And so, but what's interesting about that precludes a lot of analysis. It's mm-hmm. mostly news gathering and then going back and using that to execute. And so it's surprising to me how siloed these worlds are.
Right. It's like if you're a chicken or a pig, you may not realize that you're eating your dead friends and your own shit. Right. Like, and so you always need to analyze what's in the trough and figure right. out, like, it turns out there's a McDonald's down the street.
Yeah.
And if you just were got let out of that industrial coop, you could go get some lovely French fries or maybe a fried apple pie instead of eating your buddy.
That's a good analogy. So, I mean, horrifying, but good. So
well, that dollar menu doesn't make itself.
There's a reason you get two apple pies for a dollar. So it's cheaper than when I was six. It doesn't make any sense. The economics of it. Now that I'm thinking, I'm concerned about
fried apple cream. Pie deflation is an important issue yeah, in our global society.
One of the reasons I wanted to ask you some questions is I certainly view you as an expert, as somebody who spends a lot of time in looking at the meta things of the industry. Well, in developer circles, there's a lot of stuff that's really elementary. And if we were to sit in a group of analysts that are, or like if you were to drop a developer into a group of CIOs, the CIOs would ask the developer questions that the developer would consider idiotic, you know, like,
sure.
Hey, so what's the deal with JSON? Uh-huh. You know, I'm hearing about JSON a lot lately. Like, are you serious? Like,
or APIs.
So
we need some APIs.
Yeah. So conversely, there are things that are elementary to you that in the developer ecosystem, I was surprised to find are not commonly discussed, and they're the idea of these meta patterns. And one of them without getting into details, I got into an argument with a person who's actually a close friend, and I consider a close friend on Twitter. And I used the term hype cycle. I said, "Hey, mm-hmm. you know, like I worry about friends who are being swung around by the hype cycle because they don't understand that technology has kind of a curve to it, and so they get to a certain point and they get frustrated." And I was surprised that a lot of the reaction I got was negative reaction to the word hype,
uh-huh.
saying that, oh, you're saying these things aren't real. I was like, oh, no, there's like, you know, you can read Wikipedia. So, but it's also possible that with my limited knowledge of this, I was using the phrase incorrectly. So I'm like, no, we're bringing an expert in to explain this to us. So in broad terms, like what is the hype cycle and what is the impact?
Sure.
Technology.
Yeah, yeah. So I'll start specific and then amalgamate up to like generalizations, because the, you know, if you go read your Wikipedia page on like the innovator's dilemma, there's like this obligatory Wikipedia style paragraph about how like none of these ideas are new. They all come from Socrates. I mean, you know, not literally. That's probably more like Aristotle. But you know, it's sort of like these are ideas that get recirculated, and you know, much like the anti fried pie analogy earlier. So you know, there's a lot of things to pull in there. But the hype cycle specifically is I believe Gartner made it up. I forget when, but it's a Gartner construct. And Gartner, the big behemoth industry analyst firm, they have two major models. One of them is the hype cycle, and the other one is the magic quadrant. Maybe you have another episode about the magic quadrant. That's a lot of excitement. But the hype cycle is essentially, if you were to visualize a curve that go, like, let's say, you know, visualize a sheet of paper, and on the, what is that, left side, there's a slope that goes up really fast to the top. In a nice smooth that way. You math guys probably know what this curve kind of curve is called. It's like a bell curve. On one side is a bell curve. And then on the right side of the bell curve going down, what happens is it hits the floor and then it slowly goes back up to a flat line, right? And so imagine like a flat line on the right side of the paper and a bell curve on the other, and a little U that connects those two lines together is what the hype cycle looks like. And the point of the hype cycle is, I think there's, let's see, there'd be one, two, three, there's like four phases to it, which oddly are similar to another nice cycle. It's like Geoffrey Moore's Crossing the Chasm cycle, if you're familiar with that. It's another good one that explains the same phenomena. And basically what happens at the beginning of the hype cycle, And you're right. The name Hype is, it emphasizes just this first part. Is
it needs more hype in the sense of like hip hop or like being at a, you know, being at a concert where people
it's got big
are
clocks.
Really excited.
Yeah. Like, so, the hype part is that fast bell curve rise at the top, right? So obviously the axis is that the X axis is time, right? And so there's lots of interest and enthusiasm really soon on about a technology like Docker. Let's use Docker as
an example. That's literally the one I was thinking of.
So Docker right now is nearing the top of, well, I mean, maybe not the top, but the middle part of climbing upward, right? And everyone thinks Docker is the bee's knees, as they would say. And we get a lot of questions, surprising questions from big banks who are like, I love that Docker stuff, because this is how they talk. Can you just go tell them to make it enterprise grade? Right? Like, because if you think about it, if you boil down the Docker proposition to a very crude mainstream, it's there's two propositions, the second of which guys like yourselves get excited about. But the first one, these cigar chomping financial CIOs apparently, like, so what you're telling me is it's like VMware, but I can run more images on a box for less
licenses.
Money.
Yeah.
Right? And they're like, right, so why are we still talking?
Which, should that little zero in the front of the version number?
Yeah. So that type of hype, or that comical way of putting it, is explains the hype that you have. Now, of course, the more sophisticated thing, which is equally hypey to a certain extent, is like, hey, I'm a developer. So what you're telling me is I can just like type stuff on a keyboard, package it up, I'm done, and deploy it. That sounds awesome. And like it's all like, so there's an equal amount of hype around these two things. And we all know, being older gentlemen, that there's probably a catch. and so what happens is you get to the apex of that bell curve. And I forget the term for it, but it's like the height of expectations or something. And this is kind of, I just described that. You got the cigar chomping CIO and the developer who are all excited. And then they finally deploy it. And then at just as fast, and this is all like over the course of whatever time, but just as fast as the hype ran up there, you very quickly fall into what they call, this is my favorite part, the trough of disillusionment. And that is that you've had overhyped expectations.
You just kept thinking it would go up exponentially forever.
You were like, this thing is going to be awesome. I hear it's the best thing since Linux or sliced bread or whatever. And then you actually put it into play and you're like, did you guys curse on this podcast?
We periodically.
Yeah, and then you're just like, fuck. and like you're down in the trough, right? With the bad part, the dark stuff. And like that's when you really discover, basically it means that you use the technology before it was fully mature, right? The market as a whole did that. And then eventually what happens is you're in the trough there, you collectively as the industry, and then like the Docker company, everyone else comes in and they're like, yeah, I mean, we told you it was version 0.6. And we're working on it. And just in a few years, they add the new features and things work well and it gets road tested. And then remember I said there's a straight line on that right side. Like you slowly climb back up. And that straight line is what they call the plateau of productivity. And that's essentially like everything works. We know what's going on. And it's a two steps forward, one step back thing, right? Like it's not way at the top of that bell curve where it's like awesome. But it turns out this is better than what we had. And you can see like things like public cloud have gone through this cycle, right? Where, you know, even nowadays to read the hype of it, you're a little bit like, so I don't have to do anything. And then as you guys well know, right? Like you deploy into a public cloud and you're like, yep, there's a lot that you have to do, right? Like it's basically like now I have an IP address that I go to and install things on, which is a little better than when I had an IP address that I went to install things on before this, right? Like things are a little better, but it's not like phenomenally better. It's not like going from a...
Right. There was a lot of pain, like in circa 2007.
Yeah. It's not like going from a princess phone to an iPhone. Like there's no leap that takes that long. And then you guys know better than I do, but I imagine like JavaScript as a primary language has gone through similar things, right? Like it probably in 1999... when you and I were back at Funds Express and there was this idea from Netscape that you would be running JavaScript on the server side, there was probably all sorts of great promises and whatever that Netscape thing was, that it was going to be awesome. And I remember we tried to use it and we kind of just couldn't even install it. Like it just didn't make any sense. Whereas nowadays, that's a perfectly fine proposition that makes sense. And so the hype, you know, kind of got down to that plateau-y level. So, I mean, I think
I certainly remember going through that with Java. Right?
Yeah, I remember back
in the early days, Java was the solution to almost everything.
Exactly.
Like, oh, we'll just wait till Java does this. And then part of that trip was realizing where the technology was not
available. I'll use another thing that maybe is more common to all ages of the kids out there, and that is remember the first time you read about object orientation, right? And I guess nowadays there's all this other wacky shit people do, but like you read about OO and you're like, oh, it's this perfect solution. I'm going to model out what my entities or my objects are, and they are going to send messages back and forth to each other that coordinate things happening, right? Or like
the original promise there was, and you'll be able to take these OO classes and
reuse them.
Yeah, use them anywhere.
And similarly, I've talked with those reactive manifesto people a little bit, and like, you know, they have a similar, like, what you described sounds awesome, right? And in reality, like, nothing is as awesome as it seems, right? You have to tack back to like what it's actually good at. Like, I'll give you one last example. The other thing analysts are good at is talking endlessly. So I'll give you one more example. Like, I somewhat brutally use this example too much, but I remember when I was talking with the Mesosphere guys, getting a briefing from them, and they started off with like, this is going to revolutionize how all applications are run, right? And just to give a brief little so Mesosphere is basically like, obviously based on Mesos, which is like this, which comes from like the Berkeley lab, like the AMP lab, and like it's how Twitter runs large parts of its application. And as far as I can tell, it's basically a way of running mostly stateless apps, mostly stateless processes on a huge cluster of things, as you would do at Twitter, right? Like, mm-hmm. like you've hidden all the I'm getting ahead of myself. So they're like, ah, this is going to revolutionize how you run apps. And it looks pretty cool. And so being sort of an asshole analyst that I am, I mean, not asshole, but like sardonic, I was like, so am I going to run SharePoint on this? And like, no. All applications except SharePoint. I'm like, okay, fair enough. Like, are you? And I'm kind of making an unfair mockery of them. I'm just joking about it to make a point. And you know, sort of like, so is that going to run like Oracle Financials or Lawson, which are some business applications? And they were like, and so like you kind of have that conversation. Like, so what you're saying is the following, which is totally fine. It's a new way of running web applications. And they were kind of like, yes. And it'll also run like Spark for you and Hadoop. But it's basically like if you're using a new style of writing applications that's, you know, that you guys do a lot of, this is a great way to run it. But it's not necessarily a great way to run like the last 10 years of applications. And so it's easy. I mean, I kind of like caricatured this to show how this hype cycle can occur is you can get caught up in the idea. This also gets back to your point about programmers being too bleeding edge instead of scabbed over is like, if you're working in a world where all you're working on is like mobile apps and web apps, then of course this seems like everything, right? This like something like a Docker or a Mesosphere seems like it's going to totally revolutionize everything. But then you pull back and you drive up the street to the state of Texas offices and they're like, now does Docker have an E at the end? And what is that based on? Does that work with HP UX? Right, like you have to understand that.
It's kind of like you discover this technology that it's like this rocket that can shoot you to the moon. And you're like, wait a second. Where's all my stuff?
Well, I worked on the OpenStack team at AT&T and watched an extremely promising technology get mangled in the hands of corporate needs.
It's
really interesting to watch. Like, whoa, that's where that rubber hits the road, and that's where you're like, oh, I don't. This isn't fun anymore. I thought this was going to be like a motorcycle ride through.
And so
Disneyland.
I mean, to summarize the other point and get to more of a cultural thing of hopefully that's helpful for how. I mean, I had to reprogram myself like this too quite some time ago. How programmers can reprogram themselves to not be so naive is one, like to your point, like corporate normal people's need for IT. Is often not based on, what would you guys call it? Is it functional requirement? What's the other type of requirement? The requirement that is like, must be awesome, right? Like you have a functional requirement that's like, it has to run at this speed and like, it can only take this up, but there's another requirement that's sort of like, it has to have good usability.
I think they literally call it non-functional requirements.
Yeah. So most people don't care about non-functional requirements. Like they're given a list of things they have to satisfy and their job is to satisfy those things. Like, it has to be up on these times. We need to guarantee that when it goes down, it comes back up this fast. And there are 5 fields on it, which will allow this kind of input. And when someone fills that out, it needs to email to this person. I'm done. Right. Yeah. like the question, did this improve your life in any way, never comes up, right? Whereas if a lot of the more of the people that you guys deal with, their sort of Steve Jobsian view of programming is that they're improving life with it. But most people don't give a shit about that, right? Because it is not that they don't want to improve life. It's that they don't see programming and IT as the best way for them to do that, right? So this is the second part, is the distinction of, you have to realize that most people don't view computers as helpful or anything that they want to deal with. Like they want to stop, they want computers to get out of the way, and they would probably not like to be at work, and they want to just like go home, right? Whereas like most people that you probably interact with in yourselves, like, this is another thing that I have to continually learn about, is like when my job stops at 5, unless I catch myself, and I hopefully I've disclaimed this enough to say that I don't like this, but my favorite thing to do is to go back to work. Mm. Right. Yep. Which is not, that does not working engender. Yeah. Yeah.
Like walking around.
Yeah. Like, and this becomes a problem in life, right? Is like, you can't work all the time. Because because you know, you like other people.
I'm going to stop you.
Yeah.
Because I use Charles for this a lot. Because I know that when I send him home at the end of the day, and Charles and I go home, I'm like, oh, bye, Charles. Hey, by the way, I'm running into this really tough problem. I know that he won't be able to let it go. And he'll call me at like 9 at night. And yeah, be like, yeah. Dude, I just figured it out.
Right. And so there was a good article from, how do you say his name? That Horowitz guy, who's that, you know, that Andreessen Horowitz. And, you know, that book he has, The Hard Thing About Hard Things, is actually pretty good, even though it's all available as blogs. But he had a good post that was basically how to sell to enterprise buyers, right? And there's something you can pull out from between the lines that he gets to. And he says an interesting point. He says, I notice with our portfolio companies that they struggle to understand normal people, enterprise buyers. And what I try to explain to them is that they work to live, right? I mean, this is an old phrase. They don't like live to work. And like, if you go into something understanding that, you talk to them and treat them much differently. Because to your point of whether you were like doing your OpenStack thing or programmers, right? Like a programmer who's very involved in some node thing or whatever, you might encounter someone and like they don't know what node is, and you're like, this person should be like immediately immolated. Like just like they're worthless. Like why are they not like eating from this trough of knowledge constantly and keeping up on things? And it's just like, well, because they don't care. Right? And that's fine. Like
yeah. They're eating from some other trough.
Well, they
involve JavaScript.
Their passion, and this is actually a topic that we're going to talk about soon. Is their passion is feeding their family?
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And being able to go home and do something else.
They might have healthy priorities.
Or they might have a really big DVD collection.
Yeah.
Right. Or they like comic books. Like I mean, that's this is an issue. Is like people have hobbies and lives and stuff. And so the point is that like depending on where you are in the hype cycle, right? Like. Depending on your viewpoint on life and how you relate to technology, you view it differently, right? So if you're one of these bleeding edge people who like calls you at 9 at night, like very early on in the hype cycle, you can recognize that something is not hype and it's real. And you're like, well, yeah, I mean, only like 0.001% of the world is using and it's missing some features, but you just write some code here and then it's done. And then boom, you like, it works.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas, like, if you're one of these works to live people and you're like, so, 0.0 version of this product, why don't you call me in a couple of years, right?
So, this is a really interesting point, because I think this was actually the crux of the argument that I was involved in with this person, and we just couldn't see each other's point of view. And I actually viewed it as a demerit against their character temporarily, like, until I kind of really thought this through, that they tend to... That I see people, not specifically this one person, but I see this frequently in developer cycle, where they get on the hype cycle, they ride it to the top, and as soon as it starts feeling
trophy,
like, they start, yeah, they're like, oh, and they bail out and start the next ride.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
But the act of going, because I've done this once or twice now, I got in really early with Ember on accident. I am a plateau productivity guy completely. I love shipping things. I love going home. I don't love being the early guy because it's a lot of work. Because you have to write all that code and glue stuff together, and it doesn't work the way that you expect. And you're reading code, source code, and documentation, and none of that stuff is my jam. If the code would write itself, I would do that. But so realizing I'm the plateau guy, I prefer things to be on the plateau, and there are other people that prefer to be in the act of finding
right.
those gems. And it's only when you said that I realized it, that these people like finding these diamonds in the rough and helping guide them over the curve, realizing that there will be a trough. Even if they it's just basic pattern recognition, they aren't familiar with the hype cycle.
I think it's important. Like there's nothing morally wrong with any phase of the cycle. Like it's important for the
progress. It's good to know yourself well enough to know which parts you like to operate in, and then
I love the trough. I just live there.
That's right.
and then
the further on point is like. There's other people who like different phases of it. And to your point, it doesn't make them wrong or unwrong. It just like, they're just different people. Right. And this is kind of like the tech nerd elitist view of things is if you're not doing bleeding edge stuff, then you're not worth as much for whatever reason. But in reality, right. Like there's a lot of worth to like, you know, whenever, like, we got a passport for our one-year-old recently, right? And I guarantee you there's some plateau of productivity IT going on in that process, right? And it worked out well, and we got it, like, back in, like, 3 weeks. It was fast. And, like, I don't need them figuring out how to use, like, OpenStack to run the passport. Right? Like, I'd be happy if they were using, like, Unix or a mainframe, right? Like I want stability. And that's another thing. If you can right. gear up the empathy things in your head is in situations like this, I always like to do a search and replace on IT and think about other industries that I don't know anything about. Like, you know, when I go to the accountant to do my taxes, I don't think she thinks I'm an idiot because I'm going to her to do my taxes, right? Like, what do you mean? You don't love sitting down and filling out the paperwork to do your taxes? Like, you're worth nothing.
Right.
Right. Like she recognizes that for whatever reason she has chosen and hopefully likes, because you always want someone who likes what they do. Like, they like doing taxes and like doing accounting. And like, I don't. Right. And
right.
like, and the other analogy that was popping up into my head was like, was two things. One, like, you ever watch what's that British show that's famous of all the aristocrats in the 30s? Yeah, like, you know, they've got that fiery Irish chauffeur there, and the dude's always like fixing the car. Mm-hmm. So that would be early in the hype cycle, cars back then,
yeah.
where like not only do you need a lot of money to buy the car, right? Not only are you probably going to get a chauffeur, right? But also you're going to be fixing that car all the time, and it might break down, and you've got to tinker with it and mess with it. And like, there's lots of people who love that.
You have a dedicated guy who's literally your
yeah, brother. Yeah.
But, you have to pay to feed him.
But like, we don't want that. Like, we just want to get right. here.
The older I get, the less tolerance I have for the early part of that.
And it's.
I think it's sort of like you feel time speed up as you get older. That's like scientific or whatever. But like, and so you just see this cycle run over and over again. You're like, I rode this ride already like 5 times.
Yeah,
I want to do it again.
But I would add to that. I'm actually
the you kind still of person.
I love it, but that's also why I love stability, because stability enables that. Like, if you've got your left foot firmly planted on the ground, you can move your right foot, and you can kung fu kick,
and
you can do all kinds of crazy stuff.
And that's the point. Is like so. Let's call it a frontier mentality. To get to the other thing is like when you were talking, it also made me think of you ever see that show Deadwood, mm-hmm. It's Hearst is the guy at the end, and Hearst has this frontier mentality of like, it's all about the color for me, right? And like, all he wants to do is like go dig for gold, but he realizes, to your point, there's all this other shit that he's got to deal with, like killing people, running towns, shutting down things, like lots of other hassles. And so like, he outsources all of that work to other people so he can focus on that one thing that he wants to do. And he's very obviously brutal about this stuff. And similarly, if you have this frontier mentality for programming, like one way to make yourself less of a jerk, essentially, because you think anyone who's not as awesome as you is not awesome in this narrow field, like think about all the stuff in your life that you don't spend time doing. And that's sort of like the stability that you depend on. And there's people who do all that other stuff, right? Like, I can't think of examples, but you know, like you need stability and plateau of productivity in all walks of life, even in the IT world, so that you can focus on interesting things. And then also to your point, like some people just want to like not work all the time.
Yeah. and a couple and people can get burned. Like not every technology makes it through the trough of disillusionment. Some crash and burn there.
Yeah, exactly.
And so it's interesting to watch that cross where it's like, oh, is it going to pull up? And it's like, nope. And so you work with a few technologies like that, and it's hard to pick which ones. And you wind up becoming a little territorial and a little tribal about it.
Sure.
Programmers are really great about sticking to it, like clumping into tribes. And it's I think it's an important discussion to have, because I want to be able to separate the tribalistic aspects of it from the fact that everything kind of rides this curve. And knowing your preference for working in that curve should I don't use the word should a lot, but I feel like that should supersede any sort of tribalism.
Yeah. No, and there's two other models. I kind of mentioned both of them that are good for if you're interested in this kind of thinking, which I would say if you know, kind of ironically, like if you're a programmer and you're not interested in this kind of thinking, it means that you're just interested in not working a lot. Like you kind of ironically, this position we're saying is like, if you have a frontier mentality, you're always interested in more and more context that helps you get better at the job that you're at, right? Versus like, I just want to show up and program, right? Like I don't need to know about all this stupid business crap. But in reality, like the results of your programming exist to serve a business purpose, whether it's a consumer reason or whatever. And so it's important to understand these concepts, in my opinion, unless you just want to program, which is fine. And so one, there's like I mentioned earlier, the Jeffrey Moore crossing the chasm thing, which is basically it's the business side of how you go, you get the market to pay a lot of money for a new idea. And what it describes is it almost mirrors the phases of the hype cycle. Like you've got an early invention, like a startup, and it's very unproven and it may be good and there's early interest in it. And so you need to go after the 1% of the market that like are the early adopters, if you will. And you just nail those guys. And you see this happening at startups. Like they'll talk with each other, like highly technical people talking with each other. Like Mesosphere sells a lot to Twitter. Like I shouldn't keep bagging on them, but whatever. Got that going. And then right after that are sort of like the early majority, right? I think it's somewhere between like 10 and 15% of the market. I mean, it's a bell curve, so it's highly suspect if you've read your Nassim Taleb or whatever, but never mind that. And these are people who are like willing to take a risk, right? And somewhere in between those two things is this chasm, because the challenge is going from early adopters to being able to find people who will take a risk. And the most effective marketing thing that they go over there is you need to basically, it sounds really silly, get reference customers, or as I like to call them, bridge jumpers, right? Like, because in enterprise buying, it's like that old phrase, like if your friends jumped off a bridge, you would jump off a bridge too. And so what you need to tell people is like, look, all your friends are jumping off a bridge. and then they'll just go jumping off the bridge too, right? Because they need these reference customers to know that what looks like a risky technology works out well. And then anyways, once you get the early majority or whatever, then you've got the late majority and then you have the laggards, which are like people who are still using flip phones. Eventually, these laggards will, you know, get an iPhone. Like when it just, there's nothing else to buy, but that model is handy because if you look at the way that startups and other technologies market themselves, right, there's lots of hiccups in moving through those phases because there are different buyers and different criteria for success in each of those phases, right? Like the early adopters like want to have a technical conversation, right? The early majority and late majority, they want to have a little bit of a technical conversation, but they want to know that your shit works and they want to know that it satisfies requirements. And the laggards like are just, they just basically want price. Like they don't really care. And anyway, so then another model, it's not a model, but there's a whole book that I read a summary of instead of the book, but it was a good, read the Wikipedia article, look up diffusion of innovations.
Okay.
And that's one of the first origins of all of this stuff. And it kind of walks through not only in the tech world, but through all types of new ideas, how they kind of diffuse, if you will, or spread through society, become successful in the different kind of traps and way things don't work out. And so it's a good description of how ideas kind of propagate, if you will.
That's awesome. Diffusion of innovation. I'm going to look into that.
Yeah. There's like some fourth edition. It's a really big book that I have next to a bunch of other books I'll probably never read. So you just read the Wikipedia entry.
That's all I ever do.
That's right.
That's how I know so much about the history of Steely Dan and Skunk Baxter and all that stuff.
Oh yeah.
I'm an expert on progressive rock. Yeah. Wow. So anyway, this has been a super enlightening conversation. Thank you, Cote. This was, it helped kind of sort through some of the stuff that I've been seeing. And I hope it's helpful for other people to understand that none of these archetypes is bad. Like nobody's bad, for having a certain preference. And a technology isn't necessarily super perfect or bad. It tends to come out in the wash. Everything has trade-offs, and it's very difficult, no matter how objective you think you are, it's very difficult to evaluate those fairly when you're on the rocket ride up or when you're stuck in the trough of disillusionment. They both feel a little like you're in a little bit of a hall of mirrors. And so when you understand that, it buys you a little more patience to work with the technologies that make you happy, that make you money, you know? So I think that's really helpful to understand. So thanks for sharing that knowledge with us for free that you charge people so much money for.
Sure.
So, fantastic. All right.
I got to go listen to that FM song now. Maybe Hey 16.
Yeah. Hey 19.
Is it 19?
Yeah. Peg. Let's see.
I just turned it into something a little more.
Well, legal. Well, I don't know. In Beatles era, 17 was passable. So who knows? Who knows what the laws were like in those
no static
the
at
heady
all.
Days of the 1970s.
And what was that guy? Deacon Blues.
Yeah.
Like the Crimson Tide.
Yep.
Yeah. those lyrics, none of them make any sense, really.
No, they don't. I wish we had that song to close this podcast out.
I have no idea what you guys are talking about.
We're just rattling off
Steely Dan songs.
These guys are still living in the hype cycle of like early 70s rock. I can tell.
Right. We should probably wrap this up and then have Nathan Ladd play a guitar outro of a nice Steely Dan song. All right, Cote, thanks again, man. This has been awesome to have you.
Bye-bye.
All right, let's do this again.